Our next case this morning is number 044317. Daniel Brosted against Unum Life Insurance Company of America et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. Douglas Brown, I represent the plaintiff appellant Daniel Brosted, and this is an appeal from an order of dismissal in which the district court granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment and denied our motion for summary judgment. The nature of the case, Judge, is it involves an employee benefit plan subject to the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA. And my client filed a single-count complaint for estoppel and later amended it to include a count for breach of fiduciary duty by Unum, which was a putative fiduciary under the plan. Now, my client specifically sought equitable relief in that count, count two, under Section 1132A3. We alleged that there was a misinformation provided by the fiduciary which led him to enter into an agreement, and he wasn't advised until he wasn't advised of the of an incorrect benefit determination until after a settlement agreement he had with his employer became irrevocable. Furthermore, we did note that there was evidence. We noted to the district court there was evidence that the attorney who was representing his employer in a discrimination claim that he was pursuing to return to work was advised by the employer to contact the insurer. But in addition to that, Judge, we also provided evidence that there was that Unum apparently received premiums at a rate in which a deferred compensation provision should not have been deducted to calculate his benefits. Specifically that, and there was a question as to whether this provision should have been in the plan. And Unum received these premiums for the duration of this particular plan. It was funded through the purchase of insurance. And yet, when it came time to calculate my client's benefits, they invoked this provision, which shouldn't have been in a plan to begin with. So we alleged basically that there was a misinformation provided to my client, and it was suspicious as to whether it was knowingly, whether they knowingly withheld this information for 2 weeks to advise him until his agreement became irrevocable with his employer. And then there was this other issue of whether they unjustly enriched themselves by receiving premiums for a level of coverage that they didn't provide. And this, of course, was not learned and not contested by the employer until after his appeal was formally denied, roughly a year and a half after he initiated it back in February 2000, and then we filed a suit. Now,
can you distinguish the fiduciary duty issue from the unjust enrichment? The judge said that he wasn't going to allow you to amend the complaint because it was an unjust enrichment claim. And you're now saying, at least, that it was a breach of fiduciary duty by Unum because it was charging a high premium and giving benefits that for a lesser, what would be a, normally a lesser premium.
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, we did argue that in our response brief before the district court. We claim that it was that it was a question of loyalty, that Unum was unjustly enriching itself at the expense of my client, which was a breach of fiduciary duty in and of itself, in addition to perhaps being a separate count.
As fiduciary, what was their obligation then?
Well, I think they should have provided the level of coverage that they were being paid for. They were being paid for a level of coverage that did not allow for the deduction of deferred compensation before they calculated it. That ultimately resulted in a $513 loss to my client. It should also be noted that he was contesting improperly in his appeal that this provision shouldn't be part of the plan because he didn't have any knowledge of it. He didn't receive the SPD. He was advised by his employer, which I think is significant, that he would get the full 60%, not only orally when the plan first went into effect, but also subsequently, with a memorandum that was attached to everybody's paycheck. So there's even a question as to whether this provision should have been in the plan in the first instance, particularly since there was also documentation, a current information form, which we noted in our brief, which in which the box, the checkoff box, do you want to include deferred compensation? It was blank. So there's even a question as to whether this should have been in the plan to begin with. But Unum did invoke this particular provision belatedly after his severance agreement and release of all discrimination claims became irrevocable. I'd also note that the claims representative with whom he was in contact also made no mention of this provision during his discussions with her when his benefit determinations were made, which raises the question whether it was in their, whether the provision itself was in their computer records when they determined, what his benefit level should be. And that also raises the specter of whether it was appropriate to apply this particular deferred compensation deduction as they did. Now, in addition to that, Judge, I would point out to the court that the judge, the district judge court, when they dismiss count two of my client's complaint, which alleged breach of fiduciary duty, and I believe, again, that the unjust enrichment should have been a part of it, the judge really didn't focus on the circumstances of the evidence that we had presented in the briefs and which were in the complaint. She focused on district court focused on one thing, that we asked to recover benefits, which was in the prayer for relief. But we also asked for restitution. And I think that it was error for the judge merely to conclude from the fact that we asked to recover benefits, that this was an action that should have been brought under 1132A1B. And the reason for that, Judge, is because the facts and circumstances which we allege did not give rise to an action in contract under that particular section to recover benefits. My client was not denied benefits, and this provision was in the plan. There's no question of it, and we freely admit it. But we could not pursue a claim because, frankly, we couldn't make out a prima facie case, and I don't think we could make an argument for that. So the facts that my client found himself in, the circumstances, really gave rise to a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. And through this unjust enrichment or the receiving misinformation from these benefits, from Unum's representative. And that's really what was at issue. And we couldn't develop these facts further, quite frankly, for the second reason, Judge. We were denied the opportunity to conduct discovery. This was not a case in which the review of the court would be limited, limited to the administrative record on review, which is traditionally what courts will do in a circumstance where you're claiming that benefits were wrongfully denied. Basically, in this instance, we were examining the relationship of Unum as a fiduciary and whether they had communicated with the plan sponsor, whether they knew about this instance where he was, where my client was negotiating a settlement and relying on these benefit amounts to determine what, you know, what he should negotiate in settling his discrimination claim. There's also this instance, Judge, where we later learned about this problem with the deferred compensation clause and the payment of premiums. And the judge denied our motion to extend discovery, and we believe that was an abuse of discretion because she said it was moot But the problem, that really made no sense in the context in which we requested it, Judge. There was a motion for a protective order, which canceled all discovery after it was filed, and the judge took, you know, close to 3 months to decide that. And during that time, the discovery period expired. We asked that it be reopened so we can complete the discovery that we initiated. We were diligent. But for some reason, the judge just denied it, and I don't know. I know not why.
What was the discovery?
Well, we had three depositions
I beg your pardon? What were you after?
Well, we were after the three depositions of the people who had denied the benefits, who made the arrangements for this particular plan to go into effect, and then the woman who, the CPA, who the day after my, roughly a couple of days after my client was informed of his benefit amount, the CPA for the Unum, who decided that these benefits determinations were incorrect, but yet waited almost 16 days before she dropped the letter in the mail telling my client that, oh, by the way, we made a mistake, you're going to get a reduced rate. And as I said, that was after the revocation period in the agreement canceled, so he was prejudiced in that sense.
So he would have claimed, his alternative would have been that he would have gone back to work.
Well, yes, Judge. He was actually...
I guess you have one doctor that said he'd go back to work. The other doctor said he's disabled. Is that right?
Well, Judge, there was a question of fact on that.
Well,
and
so he would have to revert back to that he wasn't disabled and then work 3 months, change his plan so that these things aren't being withheld and he's getting his full pay, and then he would be eligible for the full disability under the... I guess the terms of the contract, and that's what you're saying. Well, they were some sort of a delay and purposeful, I guess, and that's what you want to discover. That where I was focusing before on the fiduciary thing is because there, if that were discarded by mistake or. Maybe it was error to say call it unjust enrichment as opposed to a fiduciary duty breach. Is that your position?
I would believe so, Judge. I characterize it as unjust enrichment was inappropriate as a fiduciary, but it would have been a breach of fiduciary duty
regardless of the contract, they should have paid your client according to the premium that was being paid as opposed to what the contract called for.
And make a determination whether that was the actual amount or that was the actual provision that the employer wanted based on the agreement with the employer. Because the employer continued to pay these premiums well after this was known through February 2003.
You're well into your rebuttal argument time, you know.
Yes, Your Honor. I just want to point out one other thing.
It's your time, not mine.
The court failed to consider this because, and I think this is important for future too, Judge, the court refused to consider this evidence, and they said we were amending our complaint. But in doing so, the district court seemed to rely upon a common law rule that under no circumstances can a party amend a complaint in summary judgment. And I would point out to the court that the court has, of course, denied parties to amend their complaints in summary judgment, but only after going through the review of Foeman versus Davis that the Supreme Court requires, whether it would be futile, whether there have been repeated instances. And I think that the district court's decision to decide this was arbitrary in that sense. I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Good morning. My name is Warren von Schleicher, and I represent the ERISA plan and the ERISA plan's claims administrator, Unum, the defendants in this action. This case presents an important issue for the court to decide, which is whether the Supreme Court's holding in Verity Corp v. Howe establishes a legal bar to a plaintiff who is seeking benefits under ERISA from seeking the same damages under the rubric of a 502A3 claim for breach of fiduciary duty. In this instance, the plaintiff clearly has sought plan benefits. The plaintiff has standing to seek plan benefits because he is undeniably a participant under ERISA. He has alleged in the complaint that he seeks past benefits wrongfully not paid, and he gets there by invoking a principle of estoppel, which is recognized in the context of a 502A1B claim, in order to preclude the enforcement of a provision which would exclude 401K contributions from the calculation of benefits. So the plaintiff clearly has stated in count one a 502A1B claim for benefits based on, in part, a theory of estoppel. The Fifth, Sixth, Eighth, and Ninth Circuits all have determined that Verity Corp v. Howe establishes a legal bar to a plaintiff pursuing a 502A3 claim when that plaintiff has an adequate remedy available for benefits under 502A1B. That adequate remedy being established by standing and by whether the plaintiff seeks plan benefits or a determination of his rights under the terms of the plan. And that is clearly what the plaintiff has sought in this instance. Only the Second Circuit has determined that under Verity Corp v. Howe, a claim for breach of fiduciary duty and a claim for benefits may coexist. But I believe the Second Circuit is incorrect for the following reasons. The Supreme Court in Verity Corp v. Howe was concerned that litigation expenses and administrative costs not induce employers or dissuade employers from providing these voluntary plans to begin with. If a claim for benefits and a claim for fiduciary duty are permitted to coexist as alternative pleadings, which is what the plaintiff has endeavored to do here, the appropriate party would not just be the plan, but it would also include the plan's administrator and insurer, and potentially the plan's employer, all in an effort to obtain benefits. In a case like this, where discretion is reserved to the claims administrator, discovery would be permitted in that claim for benefits under the rubric of a breach of fiduciary duty claim, and that clearly is impermissible in this circuit under a 502A1B theory. So, in permitting these claims to coexist, which the district court ultimately did not allow on summary judgment, in permitting these claims to coexist, the very concerns that the Supreme Court had in Verity Corp v. Howe would be eroded. And my concern is that plaintiffs will, as a matter of course, support their 502A1B claim with a 502A3 claim. They will pursue discovery. They will expand the defendants that they seek to bring into the lawsuit. Litigation costs will increase, and there will be other repercussions that are inapposite to this court's prior holdings with respect to the appropriate scope of a 502A1B claim. With respect to the statements of plaintiff's counsel regarding unjust enrichment, I'd like to clarify several points. First, this is a 100% employer-contributed plan. The plan states that the employer pays 100% of the premium costs. If there had been, assuming the truth of plaintiff's allegations, oral allegations, that there had been an overcharge for premiums, it was at the expense of the employer and not of the plaintiff.
Now, that's not really in dispute, is it?
That is not in dispute, and I don't think it can be disputed given the plan's clear terms.
No, I don't mean the 100%. I mean the fact that the premium was too high.
That is undisputed, Your Honor. In fact, Unum notified the employer that the premiums were too high, but the employer took no action, and importantly, the employer did not seek to amend the terms of the plan. The plan's terms are what they are, and that's an important point here. In addition, the underlying theory of the plaintiff's unjust enrichment theory, which was advanced for the first time in his summary judgment response improperly, is very different from his claims in count one and count two of his amended complaint. Whereas counts one and count two, both of which seek past benefits wrongfully not paid, whereas those counts focus upon purported reliance on the first disability check which contained an error in the calculation of benefits, the unjust enrichment theory is not based on this purported reliance. It is not based on the first disability check. It is instead based on the payment of premiums. It is, therefore, a very different claim than the claim in count 1 and 2 for past benefits wrongfully not paid. With respect to the plaintiff's claim for estoppel, which, as I indicated, really is a 502A1B claim, which invokes the equitable theory of estoppel, which is permissible in the Seventh Circuit, the plaintiff advances and the district court rejected this fundamental inconsistency that the plaintiff claims that he would have returned to work, ceased making 401k contributions, and then filed a disability claim a few months later. The district court correctly determined that one cannot claim to be both disabled and not disabled. It is a fundamental inconsistency. The plaintiff cannot claim to have reasonably relied on the first disability check if the plaintiff knew he was not disabled. Moreover, because the theory of estoppel invoked within the count one claim for benefits is an equitable theory, the appropriate standard review should be abuse of discretion. And on that basis, the court clearly did not abuse its discretion in granting summary judgment with respect to the claim in count one. Finally, Your Honor, I would like to again reinforce the importance of the holding in Verity Corp v. Howe and the concern that the Fifth, Sixth, Eighth, and Ninth Circuits have already addressed and prevented, which is that claims for benefits will be turned into much larger claims involving discovery and involving parties that this court previously had determined are inappropriate in an action for benefits. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Von Schleicher.
I don't have much time, so I just want to emphasize this. There was no adequate remedy for my client in an action to recover benefits. It just didn't exist because this provision was in the plan and there was no basis to really argue it. And not only that, there has to be some, if a fiduciary acts improperly, even if benefits are at stake in the administration of benefits, there has to be a cause of action available for the fiduciary. And this court in Bowerman noted the Merton Supreme Court decision in which that basically was the case, where 1132A3 is a catch-all for what can't be done in an action to recover benefits. So in this case where a fiduciary purportedly acted improperly, the only remedy really is available for the client. And with respect to the return to work, I just want to emphasize one thing, Your Honor, to the court. There's no question that my client is disabled. He has a terrible disease that has degenerated. He worked for these people for 25 years. They accommodated him. And it came to a point where he was, in fact, disabled. But if he wanted to go back to work and undergo the pain and suffering he would have to, the inconvenience to himself, the humiliation of having to be strapped in a wheelchair, who is us to say that he can't do that? I don't believe that the judge's decision was conclusive in that sense. I don't believe that that judicial estoppel should apply. We note the Feldman decision by this court where, if there's conflicting evidence, it should be allowed to consider. I'd like to thank the court very much for allowing me to present the case.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case. The case will be taken under advisement.